listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone.
And we are speaking from different states today with the wonders of modern technology, which didn't quite as smoothly as I'd hoped, but seems to be working now. I'm in Texas, Mom's in Iowa, and our guest today is, I believe, in Pennsylvania?
Near Philadelphia.
All right. So today we have Brian Peterson, who has more than 40 years' experience as a curator, critic, visual artist, musician, and arts administrator. His photographs are in the collections of a number of museums, and he managed the exhibition program at the Michener Art Museum, which I believe is in Philadelphia. Is that true? Yeah,
north of Philadelphia in Bucks County, near Philadelphia.
Okay. And in retirement, he has taken up videography while continuing his work as a writer and photographer. And the book that we're looking at today is titled I Give My Eyes, Stories Plus Conversations Plus Dreams by Brian H. Peterson. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Brian.
Thank you for having me.
So my first question is, how did you become a museum curator?
Wow, there's the Tolstoy length, version of that, and the Basho length, I guess. I started out in life as a musician. I came to Philadelphia to study music at the University of Pennsylvania, and through a series of random choices and accidents, I ended up going to graduate school in photography, and I became interested in curatorial work and arts administration, project management, as a way of being active in the community. And I met some people, and a friend who I hadn't seen in a while. Actually, how it happened was, I ran into this guy at an opening for a show in Center City, Philadelphia, and he had just taken a job at this little place called the Michener Art Center in Doylestown, PA. He was director of it, and he was complaining about a curator he had doing a guest curator doing a project, and he said he was talking about the guy was kind of a blowhard, and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, I said to him, well, I could do that for you. And he said, oh, yeah, you could, couldn't you? So he hired me to do that, and then I kind of made myself useful. It was one of those by your bootstraps sorts of stories, I guess, in a way. I didn't have the formal training. I did not have a PhD in art history or et cetera. I had a master's degree in photography. But I made myself useful, and that's kind of the crux of it. I found myself in that situation. I was teaching photography at the time. But the museum work was fascinating to me because it allowed me to expand my horizons tremendously. I used to call myself a fearless generalist, because I wasn't specialized in one particular area. And the museum was young and growing, and it was a wonderful privilege in a way to be a part of it, to be part of the growth of an institution. And now I'm very happy to be out of it. So. But that's the somewhere between Basho and Tolstoy.
Okay.
I guess. But anyway.
Well, one thing that I found really fascinating, in this book, which is a collection of some of your photographs and essays and poems and email exchanges. In a sense, it's really a memoir. But one of my favorite pieces is where you talk about writing as a curator, writing the exhibit notes.
Oh, is that the one about beauty?
Let's see. It's the one about you're actually kind of reviewing a book.
That one. Gosh, yeah. Yes. It's a book review, yes, that I did a kind of a professional thing. I was very active in the sort of world of museum exhibit writing when I was working, and I got to know those folks, and it was a review of a book about exhibit writing that I did for one of the magazines, the museum magazines.
Right, and just I never really thought about what it means to write those labels on an exhibit and how much creativity can go into that.
Yeah, it's an art form, really, and a form of poetry, I think, also. And my contention about it has always been that that you have to hold yourself to the same standards as you would in any other form of writing. Too often in museums, it becomes a kind of a technical thing, or another way of doing it is a sort of dumbing down thing, where they have studies that say that the average visitor to a museum is you should write for a 12th grade education, and not challenge people, and those sorts of things. And my passion in that was to try and there are many other people involved in it also, but to try and change the mindset away from that sort of insular technical museum world to embrace the whole world of literature and poetry and trust the written word to communicate, and to be able to challenge people, but also embrace, not challenge them too much, find that happy medium. So that's what that book review is talking about.
Right. And of course, in all writing, in a way, what draws us in is the story.
Yes.
And I can see where when you're writing about a piece of art, there could be a lot of different stories that you can tell about that piece.
Yes, that was a lesson that I learned kind of the hard way. I found that I had to unlearn much of what I was taught in college about what good writing is, because good writing in college situation is very functional. It's meant to convey information and analysis and knowledge and that sort of thing, but it's not meant to entertain or to draw people in or to tell stories. And I was so impressed when I began to write freelance, in the real world, how incredibly good writers are out there who really know how to find an opening line and tell a story. And there's very little that you can tell, that you can't tell in a story that you can tell. There's very little that can't be said in a story that is also said in an essay. That's what I was trying to say.
Right.
But the story, mm-hmm. you might have a chance of someone actually reading the story.
Right.
So there's that minor problem. And people writing is meant to be read, so.
And in this way, helping the individuals who think they might not be, they weren't college material and so forth, but they can enjoy what you have to offer.
Right. If you write with that mindset, unfortunately,
mm-hmm, exactly.
In the museum world, too often you have scholars writing for other scholars, and they really have very little awareness of. Just like you say, the average person who of good intentions who comes into a museum and wants to be nourished or fed in some way, and they want to be mm-hmm. able to have the work explained to them, not in a condescending way, but
right.
I think the other aspect of this is curators are often afraid to embrace the idea of voice. That it's almost as though if you have a personal opinion, there's something wrong with you, but the. But every curatorial act is a personal choice or vision, and my feeling was, why not embrace that? But at the same time, do it intelligently, so that you're working in ideas and concepts and experiences but not be afraid of using the first person singular, for example.
Right.
Which toward the end of my career, I began to do that. I got away with it somehow. I'm not sure how sometimes, but I managed to get away with it. So.
Well,
anyway.
The one thing, when I was looking through this book, I had the thought that in some ways this book is you curating your life story.
Well, that's very interesting. I think you're right. It's a kind of spiritual autobiography in a way, but my feeling was that at this stage of my life, I wanted to just trust that if I did something in a written form, and if I did it honestly and did it with my heart in it, that somehow it would all hang together, So I'm very intrigued that you, of all the stuff in that book, that you picked the book review, because that's the one I was most worried about.
Oh,
because
really?
It's the most, it comes from my professional life, as I mentioned, and it talks about stuff that, as you say, most people are not that interested in, or it's like you know, they say the saying about nobody wants to know what goes on in the kitchen in the restaurant, you know. And it's more about what goes on in the kitchen. But I tried to do it in a way that was, you know, incorporated storytelling and decent pacing and all that sort of thing that writing needs to have. But I debated whether I should put that in the book or not. I really did.
Well, I think one of the reasons that it caught my attention is because, you know, our show Writer's Voices is about writers, but it's also about writing, about the writing process. And so I just found it really, really interesting because the advice that's in that essay about writing could be applied to any kind of writing.
Right. I mean, there's a quote from Octavio Paz, if I can remember it correctly, but it's about writing passes from mouth to mouth and tongue to tongue or something like that. It has its good writing, good poetry has its own life. There's a magic to it, a kind of mystery to it. I think that's what, you know, if writing doesn't have that quality, that it tends to get banal very quickly and lose its punch. In the museum world, that's a big problem, so.
I'll just read that little piece from the essay where you are quoting Octavio Paz.
Thank you.
The staying power of poetry, rejecting the marketplace, costing almost nothing at all. It goes from mouth to mouth like air and water. And then you write 60 words, 160, even God forbid 1600. The goal of pleasing the multitude always ends up at the one, you, me, what moves us and connects us, what transforms our lives. Words do that, the right ones for the right reasons. Finding them is a journey worth taking. So I think that whole thing can be a motto for Writer's Voices.
Well, that's good. I'm so pleased and honored that you chose that passage. I kind of thought that essay was more for almost like a technical audience and addressed to the museum world, but I thought, well, you know, there's points, as you suggest, there are points in there that have a more general impact or import. So why not throw it in? So I guess that was the right decision.
I think so. How some of these pieces were things that you wrote, I'm guessing, just for this book, and some are things from the past. How did you decide what to put in? What did you, you know, did you go through mounds of material and select just a few? And I'm really interested in the process of how you put this book together.
There was not a methodology to it particularly. it was as much gut instinct as intellectual, you know, savvy. But I started with let's put it this way. I tend to write not sporadically, but I'm not writing every day. Typically, I write when something really moves me. And in fact, I it's funny. I heard a memoirist interviewed one time, who said that if you're really feeling something strongly, if it just happened to you or whatever it is, you should write another book in between to get distance on it. You know. the danger being that it would turn into something maudlin or something self-indulgent. You know, you're so caught up in your own feelings that you stop making good writing. But it's funny, I find the opposite is true for me, and I'm not sure why. It's just my style, my habits, or my proclivities. But I find that if I'm not really deep inside the feeling, and if the feeling isn't really important to me, then the words don't come. I have to feel that deep connection to what I'm trying to articulate, and that's what gives me the energy, the excitement to make something out of it. So that doesn't quite answer your question, but that's sort of a starting point anyway. That I have to feel it strongly, and it is a kind of catharsis for me. But at the same time, I try and be very, very disciplined and focused with the actual words chosen, and be very careful with adjectives.
Right.
Adjectives I just tend to murk things up a bit sometimes. they don't leave enough room for the reader to ponder, and there's no space around an adjective. It says this is what you're supposed to feel, and that's it, you know. But then oddly enough, the feeling is never very precise with an adjective. Whereas if you find the right noun, the right object, the right thing that speaks it's symbolically or emotionally, that seems to be what really grabs, you know, or is really the crux of good writing, at least for me.
Or the right verb. I guess, the right verb can do that too.
Yes, exactly. But in my experience, I had a writing teacher who really took me to the woodshed, over my excessive use of adjectives. And I thought I was mad at him at first, like, well, how dare you insult my adjectives? You know, they're wonderful, they're flowery, they're glorious, they're rich and full of substance and meaning, my wonderful adjectives. But he kept beating me up about it, and he was right. He said, write a whole page without any adjectives as an exercise, you know. That would be very hard, but I do think that there's a lesson in that with good writing, for me, the way I do it. I'm not saying that there's not a million ways to do it, but there's a kind of a reserve that you take as it becomes your part of your voice, where you're not pounding on people to say, this is what you're supposed to feel, and this is what I feel, so you've got to feel it too. But you work a more subtle, sort of nuanced a flow of things, where it may seem that you're just describing some scene, some event, some happening that you happen to observe. But then as it unfolds, if you pick the right facts, you know, the right nouns, objects or descriptions, there can be a kind of strange personality that works into it, and it is, I think it's generally much more pleasant enjoyable for readers to not be told constantly that this is what I'm supposed to feel. You know, there's no room for relationship there. See, and mm-hmm. So anyway, that doesn't answer your question. But the process was it was partly to find a way to organize or make a kind of overall structure for the book out of stuff that I had already written, but also there was plenty of new writing for it also, so I just tried to make a kind of an arc to it. I start out with in a certain place and move the writing to another place, honestly, beyond that, I can't really quite quantify it. Maybe that's a start anyway, to answer your question.
Is it a little bit chronological or not so much?
Honestly, I did not have that in mind particularly when I wrote it, when I put it all together.
Okay.
But it's more like it starts out with sort of, there's a lot of tough stuff. I mean, like the first piece in the book is about the death of my mother. And it was a very, very emotional thing to write about, as you might imagine, then there's the death of my dog, you know, and the death of a friend, and sometimes those people were kidding me about it, you know, like, gee, Brian, give us a break, you know. But then there's a kind of a hiatus or where it moves away into other areas, and then it kind of works back into the tough stuff, but then at the end, I hope there's some kind of a transformation or a change that happens, and my hope is that the whole thing has a kind of a flow to it or an arc to it. That I feel that the habits of people as we read are very sort of quirky. Some people like to read in a big rush and finish the whole thing. Others like to keep a book, you know, by their bed table or something, and just whenever they feel like it, pick it up and read a few pages. And so I tried to make a book that was useful for both, conceivably, you know. So if you want to just read a few pages and get a little dose of braai, you know, then it can be read that way, or it can be read you know, very 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 quickly. I mean, So,
and it doesn't have to be read from beginning to end either.
Correct. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there. I mean, it's just sort of the nature of my personality. I think I kind of joked about being a fearless generalist, but I get bored easily. I guess you could put it that way. I'm not one of these kind of artists or creative people who gets focused on one single thing and pursues it doggedly for my whole life. I mean, I've done photography and writing and music and, now videography. It's just the way I'm oriented. So it's one of the problems with my books that they tend to not fit into neat little categories. You know? I mean,
that's
the publishing
true.
Industry is all about, is it fiction? Is it nonfiction? Is it children? Is it science fiction? Is it memoir? Is
right.
it biography?
Right.
Everything has to fit
right.
into a category. And mine never quite do, you know. But,
how did you decide which pictures to choose for this book?
Wow, that's an interesting question, and not easily answerable. But for one thing, I worked with an excellent designer who I've worked with on other projects, and we've developed a very good relationship, and I trust her opinion. And so many of those choices, they're all mutual, but I let her kind of spread her wings with it and make some choices. And she would pick some that I thought, wow, I wouldn't have picked that one. And we talk about it. And sure enough, she'd have a reason for it that was quite credible. So there was no particular formula. But the pictures in this book are more they're moments of respite, or the book is not a picture book per se.
Right.
It's not like a coffee table book. It's some weird amalgam of a coffee table book and a memoir and
and a book of essays
right.
And like
well,
say,
sometimes it's good to have
biography.
A pair of fresh eyes to look at things too, you know, and that's what she did. So that's good.
Yes, that's very true.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Brian H. Peterson, author of I Give My Eyes, Stories Plus Conversations Plus Dreams. So, Brian, part of the book, you do talk about your struggles with Parkinson's disease.
Yes.
Was that a main motivation for putting this book together?
I suppose the most honest answer is no. I didn't want to write a book about Parkinson's per se. There are many books like that out there, and they're much more useful than mine is for people who have Parkinson's and want to learn about it. I read many of those books, and they're very well done, and most of them are not really good writing, you know? And that's okay. That's not what they're meant to be. But I wanted to. I suppose you could say that the Parkinson's is in the book because it's in me. The book is about me, ostensibly. And so Parkinson's I'm 11 years into it now, which is a long time. Honestly, the fact that I'm able to do things like this interview still surprises me, you know, because
mm-hmm.
various aspects of what you need to talk at some length begin to fade away. Part of the answer is no to your question, but part of it is also yes in the sense that, Parkinson's has not been, it's been a revelation and a learning experience in many ways for me. That sounds like a weird cliche, but I think there's something about this particular illness. Which, because it's so slow and because it's so comprehensive in a sense, in the way it attacks systems in your body, that, you know, if ever I wanted to or needed to, for bad reasons, convince myself that I was not mortal, you know, the disease will every day in creative ways will rise itself up and kick me where it hurts, you know. Which is an odd kind of gift in life, I think, because so often we build these little cocoons around ourselves, and so we don't have to really face the tough realities. And that it can be a gift of illness. And I've tried to make it that way with myself, mainly by just being honest about it and not being afraid to write about it when necessary, but also not letting it take over and become my sole reason for being, you know, and doing. I tried to sort of integrate it into the larger structure of the book. And so yes, it's about Parkinson's, but it's also, it's all about me.
You know, I have a very dear friend who was diagnosed with Parkinson's about the same time. Like, she's been dealing with about the same length of time as you have.
Right.
And when she first told me, she said, I have the worst news that I could have other than something that would kill me. You know, or like a terminal cancer or something. It was sort of like,
right.
Maybe Parkinson's does and eventually end up as the cause of death. I don't really know, but you know, it takes a really long
directly
time.
Or indirectly. Yes.
Yeah. And you know, I still remember that. You know, it's like, wow.
How's your friend doing?
Well, good days and bad days. I don't see her very often because she isn't up to it very often.
Yes.
Yeah. And she couldn't do this interview. She couldn't talk for an hour. She has struggled with her voice. Yeah.
Right. Voice is one of the typical areas that it attacks. And I think the whole nature of the illness is such that it reduces and ultimately eliminates your ability to control what you normally want to control and need to control to be functional in the world. And that's very terrifying to people. Of course, for a good reason. It was terrifying to me too. When I was diagnosed, it just rocked my world because there was no place in the way my life was supposed to work out for something like this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think those first few months or years, when no one can tell you for sure how it's going to unfold, the disease is very variable. Some people get tremors, some people don't. I never had tremors myself. But those first few years are especially difficult. And I think of famous stories like Robin Williams, who was in his 60s and I believe and was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And imagine a guy with his talent, you know, his physical abilities, his ability to improvise, incredible gifts. And he was looking at the slowly the dissolution and taking away of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And look what happened, you know, tragic. It was true for me also. In other words, the first, basically, typically you have to be monitored for at least 2 or 3 years before they can begin to tell you which direction you're going to go. And there's a lot of variability, and there may be 15 or 20 different symptoms that can manifest at any given time. Some of them are primary, some of them are secondary. You know, some people say it may be 3 or 4 illnesses at once, all kind of moving at different speeds. But there are relationships between, and anyway, it's a very uncertain, it introduces a level of uncertainty, let's put it that way, into one's life that is almost intolerable. But you know, I find that you get used to it, and if nothing else, it actually makes me more and more increasingly determined to squeeze every drop I can out of life, because you just appreciate it more. You know, you appreciate when you start to lose things, it's when you really appreciate them. You put it that way. So,
you know, I didn't know that tremors wasn't necessarily a symptom. I thought that was how you knew you had Parkinson's, was the tremors.
Well, there are different subspecies of them. Mine is more rigidity. It affects my ability to especially for me, it's my gait. My ability to walk is almost gone now. But it has not affected my cognition as far as I know.
And
you
that's
tell
a
me.
Good thing that you wouldn't know if you didn't. If you were losing it, you might not be aware of.
Yeah, you lose your the tools you need to discern.
Right.
But But with me, it started out as rigidity, especially my legs. And my wife said, she said, Brian, you should go get that checked out. And I said, I just walk like my dad does, you know, and he kind of shuffles but then it began to be some signs of malfunction in my arm, one of my arms. And then we said, get thee to a doctor. And because thee might have had a stroke, you know. So I did go to a doctor, and long story short, I got MRIs and various things, and finally went to see a neurologist, and she said, well, I was utterly shocked. I mean, I went in there thinking that she's going to say, get out of here, buddy. What are you wasting my time for? But she said, now comes the hard part, was her exact word. I think you have Parkinson's disease. And I was like, it was just shocking.
Wow.
And the way they tell, by the way, is they start giving you the drugs. That's the way it was for me anyway.
And if they help, then...
Yes, it's one of the only time I think I've taken a drug where I don't want it to work, you know.
Oh man!
but sure enough, I took the drug, a very small dose, and my wife and I were taking a walk, and she said, you know, your walking's a little smoother. I said, yeah, it is. Oh, geez, you know.
Oh boy.
Great, you know, but that's how they more firmly diagnose it.
Part in the book where you're writing about the disease, you're exchanging emails with a friend of yours who had been struggling with MS for a long time.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think it's in there that where you write about, you know, all the people with their anecdotal miracle cures.
Yes.
and how annoying that is.
Yes.
And more than annoying, actually painful that can be.
Well, I think they're the professionals at that, and they're just the amateurs, the everyday people. But it's the people who, the professionals at that, are the ones who really make me mad, because basically they're offering false hope, and they're making money out of it to people who are sick and suffering. And there are a few people worse than that on this planet, in my opinion. There are worse, but not many.
Yeah.
Because you see websites, when I first started to research the illness, you know, you just put in Parkinson's into Google, and very quickly you run into these people who say, you know, the doctors don't want you to know about this. Give me $100 for my miracle cure. And, you know, it's, those kind of people are just, you know, so somewhere down near the bottom of the ninth pit of Dante,
Yeah.
Those are bad people, in my opinion, because to take advantage of illness and for one's own profit is you know, just the opposite of everything that a civilized person stands for and believes in, you know. So.
And I have a lot of acquaintances and friends who will believe any of those and think that all doctors and all pharmaceutical companies are evil.
Yeah, would that were so. It'd be so simple, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I'm very heartened by the fact that I know there are many, many very smart people who are out there working on this illness, and I don't think I'm going to benefit from it, but my guess is within 5, 10, 15 years, they're going to have something that can help it. And right now, the only thing that really can possibly have an effect on slowing it down is exercise. The drugs are all palliative. They reduce symptoms. But there isn't a single drug out there that's been proven to actually affect the progress of the illness. And anybody who tells you otherwise is probably, you know, boy, grab your wallet and run, you know, as this saying goes.
Yeah.
Because that's just a hard reality. Now sometimes they get lucky, you know, they'll be working on it and they'll try something and that happens. But it's not too likely in this case because the disease is too complicated. You know, there's so many different processes going on, and it can be triggered by anything from a blow to the head to pesticides. You know, so figure that out.
Wow. Yeah. You know, I saw some billboards over in Nebraska a few years ago where they were researching. It's funny that it was on a billboard, but researching the connection between pesticides and Parkinson's.
And Parkinson's?
Yeah.
That's been pretty well determined.
Has it? Yeah, this was probably 8-10 years ago that I saw that. So
my understanding is they've done demographic studies of people who live in farming areas versus urban. And oddly enough, the farming areas tend to have a somewhat higher incidence. And I think it's because of the pesticides and, you know, things that are used that's one theory anyway. So also men get it more than women. I'm not sure why that is, but that's it seems to be like 60-40 or something like that. The more men than women get it, but for whatever reason, no one quite knows, I guess. But
Brian, why don't you read a little bit from I Give My Honor?
Sure.
Great.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I thought I would read it's rather short, kind of the title essay of the book, which is called I Give My Eyes. And it's the story of an incident in our backyard where a deer sort of invaded the yard for a while, and I was captivated by her. So it's called I Give My Eyes. At dusk, a deer in the yard, a doe. She stands silently for several minutes, alert, wary, sniffing and tasting the cold air, waiting, listening. Suddenly she moves, head down, nibble of dead grass, head up, eyes forward, then sideways, ears twitch, head down again, nibble of dead grass, another nibble, nose up high in the air, then again, down. Three big bites of brown crabgrass. She steps forward, eyes wide, testing the wind. Then head down again, more nibbles, steps, sniffs, and bites. More sniffs, twitches, ups and downs, over and over, never the same. All is repeating, but nothing the same. She is both a ballerina and a blade of grass in a gentle breeze, moving to a precise, rhythmic, intelligently unintentional dance of perfectly choreographed line and form. What's going on out there? Helen comes up quietly behind me, sees the deer through the back porch window, stops. Are we this beautiful too? I ask, turning toward her. You know, people. I point to myself. Us? She scans my frame from head to toe, scratches her chin, smiles. Maybe it depends on who's looking, she says over her shoulder as she walks back into the kitchen. The deer moves, and with every step, a perfectly sculpted form disappears. While another blossoms before my eyes, budding, dying, blooming, budding. No way to tease them apart, yet each, coalescing briefly, leaves me breathless for the next. The deer moves, and she is a mortal flesh and eternal moments of grace. A living archetype of the ordinary beauty folded into every vibrating molecule in the known and undiscovered cosmos. The deer moves, and my eyes are two periscopes raised up from the deep waters, surveying creation with curiosity and delight. Yes, I answer my own question. We're as beautiful as the deer. We are. We all bear the stamp, the mark of the maker. The beauty is in us, in everything. We just have to stop blocking the periscope. We need to step aside and let what's in out and what's out in. If only you could see how beautiful you are to me, croons the maker's mark in ourselves, in our souls. For 20 years, deer have roamed through the backyard, invading my gardens, stripping bark from favorite trees. Deer are as common and as welcome as ants at a picnic. But that doe, that day, is a messenger. And this is the message she brings. Every living thing has the mark of the maker in its molecules and can't help but be beautiful. And who would make something beautiful and then not love what had been made? The world is full of horror and terror and mayhem and random death. It's the way things are. Maybe even the way things need to be. Still, the deer walks in beauty, not knowing, being. But today, I see her beauty and know it in myself. To observe and to be the thing observed. To hammer the nail home, right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing. This is what I've been looking for as long as I can remember. To open my eyes, then get out of the way and let the dance begin. That evening, my wife told me I stood like a statue for a half hour, maybe more, watching the doe move through our yard. The look on Helen's face said, "Come on, tell me, what were you seeing?" I didn't know what to say. I'd seen it before, but never so clearly, so simply, that stamp of beauty, the maker's mark. I gave my eyes to God today. The word sounded hollow, disembodied. I glanced at Helen, shrugged my shoulders, and mocked defeat. But that was my answer to her silent question. I wasn't sure why those words came to me or what they meant, but there they were again, wanting a second chance, another dance. This time they almost felt real. I give my eyes to God.
And that was Brian Peterson reading from I Give My Eyes, Stories Plus Conversations Dreams. Thank you for sharing that, with us.
That was really beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me read. It's fun.
You know, Brian, as I was reading from this book, which it's a beautiful book, by the way, it's physically beautiful, the paper, weight of the pages, the cover, it's very well done. And
thank you.
But one of the things that it made me think about writing memoir or autobiography and how difficult it is to achieve the right balance between being completely honest and open and oversharing.
Yes.
And I feel like you really, really hit the nail on the head. I feel like I, from reading this book, I totally know you.
Wow. That's kind of scary. I didn't mean to be flip about it. I'm honored by what you say.
One section after another, there was something I was able to get something from every part that I read, and that is unusual.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you one thing on that subject. I found that almost in relation to something that we were talking about before. I found places where I was. Let's put it this way. Another memoirist I heard interviewed one time said was asked the same question, a similar question. How do you know when it's just you when it's you being useful versus you being self-aggrandizing? And what he said was, I know if I'm feeling uncomfortable, it's probably good.
Yeah.
And if you're saying I can't believe I'm going to say that, gosh. But yeah, it seems to fit. I'll go with it, you know. But wow, do I really want people to read about that? I mean, oh man. But I think I've noticed what happens is the places where I'm most uncomfortable, where I'm most fearful that I've revealed too much or said something that's so off the wall that I'll alienate people, is where I get the most reaction. You know, the people seem to be grateful for that kind of openness, as long as it's done with a kind of generosity. Where you're trying to reach out to people, you're not just talking to be for the sake of talking. There's a sense of relationship there, I guess you could say.
Right.
But that has surprised me that where I most was fearful that people would think I'm just off my rocker, where I get the most grateful kinds of comments.
Well, see, when you have a lot of different talents, and you're sharing those with your reader, and they're reacting to that because they're seeing you, and they're seeing your world, and how you look at it, and you're able to tell them, and that's a real talent.
Well, thank you. I guess the metaphor that always comes to my mind with this is nourishment, and it has to do with my own early adulthood. I was so nourished by the work of artists that I loved, from Rembrandt to Whitman to composers of various kinds, and Bach. I used to come home and play Bach on my crappy old piano, and when I had a hard day, and I play a Bach Prelude and Fugue, and all of a sudden I'm in touch with really what really matters in life, the really deep honesty about feeling and transfiguration and just meaning. And I guess all that exposure to art, which I learned to love, this idea developed that maybe I can be part of that too. Maybe I have mm-hmm. something to offer and hopefully in all humility, maybe my experience can somehow be nourishing to others. And that's really what it's about to me. I mean, it's the stuff of fame and career and all that. I mean, I'm not saying I'm some saint, but I don't think about that stuff. But I hope to keep it motivated or rooted in something more substantial and more honest. I mean, so I'm not doing it just for faith, success itself, but because there's some other purpose with it that's really, really, really useful to people. So every time I get an honest reaction, I'm thinking, yeah, I guess it worked for that one, So anyway.
I think that, if you sit down and write a book because you want to be rich and famous, well, maybe that works for some people, but I don't think it actually works. I think the motivation has to be the desire to really connect or to tell a story.
Which
telling a story, even if it's a completely fictionalized story, is a way of connecting with people.
Right.
And if you kind of like, I used to write songs, and I performed as a singer-songwriter a little bit. I'm not that talented a musician, but people, I think, really liked to hear me perform because I was willing to really connect with the audience. No, it wasn't my singing ability, I can tell you that much. But it was the honesty with which I was, which I tried to approach it.
Yeah, I think it's partly honesty, and it's also having grown into your own skin in life, so that you have a sense of what is honest. I mean, when I was younger, I wanted to be honest, but I didn't know how because I didn't have enough experience to separate the wheat from the chaff. And as you grow older and experience more of life and get knocked around a bit, you tend to grow up and get an instinct for what matters and what doesn't. And that's where I think, I mean, gosh, there have been a lot of singers and others who you could point to them and say, well, what lousy singers they are, because they don't have the right technique. But for some reason, people like it,
Right.
It's because it comes from the heart and it has a certain wisdom, discretionary wisdom in it. So you learn to select out from all the different thoughts and impulses, ones that have a certain weight to them, Yeah, I think I read an interview with Robert Bly one time where he said, it's of course a crazy thing to say, but he said, no poet writes a good line of poetry until they're 30. a totally outrageous thing to say, but he was making a point about it that as one gets more mature, typically, and if you're doing it creatively and with a sense of growth in it, then you get better at making those selections. In a sense, and I think that's what he was trying to say.
Right. There's a word that gets thrown around a lot, even in the business arena, but it really, I think, is true, and that's the importance of authenticity. of being authentic. Yeah.
Another word that a friend of mine used, a visual artist, was integrity.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a related concept.
Exactly.
Integrity meaning that you're not going to do something because, so, as we were saying, because it will be successful only, but because it comes from some honest place, some honest need inside of you to express itself.
And there's a need inside so many of everybody, I think, to receive that authentic expression and be able to connect with someone that you may never have the opportunity to meet in person. Or to actually speak to. You know, we're very fortunate that we get to speak with a lot of the authors that we connect with on the page.
Well, take Johann Sebastian Bach. I mean, you know, I come home and play a Bach fugue, and it's really great, you know. But if I had sitting next to Bach on a bar stool or something, I wouldn't know what to. He'd speak a different language, and you know, and he died 200 years before I was born. And, I mean, there'd be nothing in common.
Right.
Except the language of music is so potent and so lasting that if you have to learn it. I mean, often it doesn't just come to you, but you have to be drawn to it and learn it a little bit. But, I mean, there's something about great or good art that seems to transcend the generations and sort of sort itself out and be nourishing to people. And I really think it's a universal. I have a certain faith in the fact that it's a universal aspect of being human, that we all we all long for something other than the quotidian, you know, the daily grind, and that there's that in us which dreams and wants to be transformed and wants to learn about and think about things that are beyond the daily stuff, and I of course that impulse gets perverted horribly sometimes, and people do awful things because they think what they've found is the best and only way, and I think that's a very dangerous side of this stuff. But I think it's something that unites us as human beings, that we all dream of things and have intimations of things and I mean, Wordsworth has that famous poem, Intimations of Immortality. And it's not like for most of us, we don't get this big, you know, heavens open and the choirs sing and beams of light come out. It's more of a kind of a daily quality wondering. I mean, one of my favorite poets is Carl Sandburg, and he has a great poem called Fog Numbers, I think. But the last line is something like, long ago as now, little men and women knew the singing and the aching of these stumbling questions. I think that's a lovely way of putting it. Mm. You know, the biggest questions are kind of a singing and an aching, as opposed to, you know, the big answer and figuring it all out. You know? So anyway, I agree with you. That I think that's correct, what you were saying.
Well, Brian, we're about out of time. Are you working on any future? Do you have any other books planned?
I think it's maybe my final one. I did a lot of them when I on my job, and I've done three of these memoir-y kind of things, and I think I've plumbed the depths of that subject. But I've been doing videography and writing shorter pieces of, you know, for blogs and stuff is reaching out to people on a nice sort of grassroots level is something I'm very intrigued by, and so that'll probably continue. I doubt if I'll do another book because it's so much work and there's so much risk involved.
How long did you spend working on this one? Was it
years? Several years. I mean,
yeah.
My last one came out in 2011, and then this was, 2018. So I wasn't working on the book all that time, but it goes back in the years anyway. So.
And it's published by DuSante Press in Bethlehem.
DuSante, yes.
DuSante, can you tell us
a little
bit about
them? Yeah, the press is a new and interesting offshoot of a gallery I'm involved in. And it's a certified 501c3 now, and the idea is to produce artist monographs and poetry books and that sort of thing. It's just getting off the ground now, so. You know, but it's very exciting, and it should be a very, very swinging thing in the next few years.
Well, it doesn't sound like you're very retired.
I was talking to a friend the other day. He said, Brian, when are you going to take a victory lap? I said, well, when I'm sure I've won the race, you know. I don't know. That puts it in a you know what I mean. It's,
right.
I've asked myself that question many times. And look, as long as it's fun for me, I'm going to keep on doing it. And that's the bottom line. It's been, I've had such a good time since I retired. Oh, my gosh. The video stuff and everything has been just utter joy for me. So a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed it.
And, Mom, do you have some final words for us?
I do. Believing you can is the first step on the way to accomplishment.